Hey, everybody, welcome to the Tim Ballard Podcast. Very special episode today. Two of my very best friends in the world. We've been working on a project together for almost a decade now, and it's just coming out. You know what it is. We've been talking about Sound of Freedom. But here we have with us the screenwriters of the movie, Rod Barr and Alejandro Monteverde. Alejandro also directed the film. And we're here because last night was the big premiere of Sound of Freedom. So, how are you guys feeling?
Good. Actually, Rod was today doing, he's also a numbers man.
Yeah.
He said today, exactly today, it's 8 years.
Yeah, exactly today.
You gotta be kidding me.
This date, 8 years ago, we were up
in Park City.
In Park City, meeting each other for the first time, not meeting each other, but actually talking about the movie doing the research for the to the day. I don't mean like,
are you serious?
Today. Yeah.
That's a tender mercy then. That's just God saying what's up.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's talk about that. So I remember going to this cabin a little nervous, a little excited, a little like not knowing what this is. I remember we did CrossFit.
Yeah. Well, actually you did CrossFit.
Yeah.
El Hunt.
I think I was showing you CrossFit for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah, he almost passed out.
Well, it was the oxygen. Well, you came from LA, so the oxygen's thin up here. And I think there was an elk walked through. There might have been an elf, or there might have been an elf or two up in Park City. You never know. Anyway, so then we wake up the next morning, I sit down. You hook me up, and what was your experience, Rod? You go first. What was your experience? What was that like? We're sitting there talking, and you don't know what's coming out.
Yeah, no, super intense. Got sort of memorably otherworldly because, I mean, first of all, I don't think you'd talked about it in this way a lot. I mean, obviously you live it, but I don't know that you'd gone over a lot of these memories or that a lot of the stuff you hadn't actually talked about.
Right.
Certainly not sort of with people in this sort of setting. So speaking for me, it was super intense. Because of the material that we were learning. Like everyone, I think, who experiences an understanding of this issue for the first time, your mind is blown. You're like, this can't be true, but I know that it is because I trust him. And so that part of it was super intense, but your intensity was very palpable too. There was crying. There was a lot of emotion. It was not sort of a normal interview. Like, gathering information. It was gathering information, but I think there was a transmission of the intensity of what we had to actually capture. Like, it wasn't just a normal set of facts and then let's make a story. It was that, but it was a lot more.
It was very emotional for me. I remember. I brought one of the HSI agents.
Yeah.
Who was on, because I wanted you to hear a second witness.
Yeah.
Like, I swear this happened. I swear. He was the one with Oshinsky, right? That we worked on that case together.
Yeah.
What were you thinking, Alejandro, as you were interviewing me the first time?
For me, I felt like I was introduced to a darkness that I didn't even know it existed. It was shocking, and I knew of the problem. I just didn't know how dark the problem was. And for you, because you've been at it for many, many years, you were telling us with a little more, you know, you were more familiar with the team. For me and for him, after we went to sleep, we woke up the next day and I said, you sleep? He was like, no, man. And there was a certain level of, is this really happens? I mean, this is the darkest of the darkest. And today in one of the interviews, they asked me, do you ever hesitated to continue on the project? And the crazy thing, and my answer was right away, I say no, there was no hesitation. The calling was way greater than any fear or any struggles that we experienced throughout the project. Mm-hmm. It was a profound calling. And I don't know if you remember, and all of this is coming today after all these interviews, we were, you know, I had hired Gorka to do another film, not Sound of Freedom. We were meeting and everything in the other movie.
Hank Gorka's he's the
photographer. And the other movie just stopped, and all of a sudden this just went from 0 to 100. before you arrived, we were talking about that. Like, what is the experience on this movie? And it's either we're going 2 miles per hour, we're going 200 miles per hour. It's never in the middle. It's either the movie's parked or we're going like right now. It's 18. And we wrote the script. It was parked. And all of a sudden, we're on a flight to Colombia and then we're in the jungle.
Yeah.
It's more extreme.
Yeah. And then I remember there was 2 days of that madness. Then you sent me home for at least 24 hours, maybe longer. And then I remember I came back and we went down to the basement.
Yeah, if you just showed a picture, you should show that picture of all the postcards.
Oh, yeah, I sat there and you had the post-it notes.
Elf and postcards.
Yeah. English is a second language. Yeah, it's a real thing. Yeah. It's okay. So, I just saw this almost rainbow of maybe hundreds of post-it notes. I don't know how you write a script of post-it notes, but I'm sure there's a method to that madness. And I sat down and you stood up and you're like, okay, here we go. And you proceeded to tell the story.
I still remember the opening. We opened with a tire. I remember.
Yeah.
How much?
It's changed.
If you put a percentage on, because I can't even remember, the first story, how much of that first story arc from that?
I will say at least 75%.
Yeah, 70%. I think of the basic ideas.
The first act is the one that we kept working.
Yeah,
the first act
we rewrote 100 times. The third act.
It was Haiti, but it was the same.
The middle portion was all
that's right. We went to Haiti. Good thing you didn't, because that's coming in the next.
Exactly. Iteration. Hey, exactly. Yeah. That was perfect.
But even that first day or that first weekend, I remember we were already, you and I were already talking, the three of us were talking about, well, if Haiti doesn't work, maybe we set it in Colombia and it can be far. I mean, do you remember those conversations?
I do, vaguely, yeah.
Vaguely, yeah. So it's amazing the percentage of stuff from that first weekend that actually made it in is pretty high, but the first act we were a million times.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding very much.
And you were part of the whole process. I mean, we will be calling you at least every 2 to 3 hours. Hey, team, we will be short. Can we do this? No. Boom. We wouldn't even try to convince you. When it was a no, we would hang up. And sometimes it was like, let me think about it. Let me get back to you. And you will get back to us like within maybe longer. It was like a day. And then you come back. It's like, well, you don't necessarily didn't happen that way, but, and then you give us some more information that pop ideas, because this is what I've been telling everybody, every biopic in the history of cinema, you're taking sometimes 20 years, 30 years and putting in 2 hours. It is impossible. You have to, modify the way things unfolded in order to fit in 2 hours. So the main thing is to capture the essence. And that's what we're focusing. This is a heroic journey from a character that was willing to do and lose his own life in order to go rescue the children of the world. I remember one day I asked you a question. I say, but the kids were not American. I don't know if you remember. And you were like, well, for me, all children are children. They're not necessarily a part of a nationality. And that's when it hit me. Wow, as a collective human and the world, we are okay by defending the whales and the trees. And we don't say, well, let's protect the whales of Brazil. It's the whales. Why we don't do that with the children? The children should never be associated. They should have a protection, worldwide protection. And I remember that came from you because, it's one of the things that made you dive in into this, because you saw the children that were being raped and they were pretty much taken as your children.
Well, you have to remember too, the whole kind of premise for why I left the government was I was fighting that very argument.
Yeah.
And it wasn't anyone's fault. It wasn't my boss's fault, but they were saying the same thing is, where are the Americans?
Yeah.
Where's the American predator? Where's the American child? Well, I've said the same. Who cares?
Yeah.
There's children and we're about to stop this. Sorry.
Yeah.
I get it, but you got to come home.
Yeah.
So I'm very sensitized already to that. There's no such thing as an American child or a Brazilian child or, a Colombian child.
Let me ask you a question, because today one of the interviews came up and I just asked and I said, when was the last time you Googled and said, how many children go missing in the United States a year? And I, you know, it was today, and they pick up the phone and and the first thing that came was the FBI. 417,000 children go missing in the United States a year. Why don't we see that? And then right under, it said 800,000 by another number. So, you know, like, why do you think that if there's 400,000 children, why that's not in the news?
Exactly. In a country that is the largest consumer of child sex material. And the same argument I make about the southern border, which we talked about, where 85,000 children have showed up unaccompanied, thousands of them, if you look at the CBP numbers, thousands of them are under 5 years old. So okay, a five-year-old, a four-year-old showing up alone with a name in her hand. Here's the sponsor. Okay, they call the number. Bye-bye. You know, in the economy of pedophilia, that doesn't work. And that's the part we don't look at. I call it the economy of pedophilia. Where's the demand? Where's the supply?
Yeah.
The United States, we are leading in many categories in the demand for child sex activity. So it's time to wake up to those numbers and attach it to that evil economy. So I want to talk about some like favorite scenes, but I'm going to show you some artifacts and see if you can even guess what some of them are. Let's start with this one. These are real artifacts.
Okay.
Does this ring a bell at all?
Yeah. Is that the end credits? That's when you're wearing, when you get arrested.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what you're wearing.
It's an iconic.
It's iconic.
I remember perfectly, you know, he's on the floor.
Do you remember the story? It's not necessarily in the film.
So the epilogue.
Who owns that hat? Do you remember? That was on the hat. That was on the head of one of the traffickers. And I wanted it back. Yes. So that's Fuego's hat, the real Fuego. And I asked him on the island, like, what's that? What do you like? You like Chet? He's like, I'm a revolutionary and how we're going to sell little girls.
Yeah.
And I said, before you get arrested, I'm going to own that hat.
Yeah.
It's my trophy.
Yeah.
And so like minutes before the raid happened, I knew when it was going to happen. You
know? Yeah.
I said, hey, bro, can I see that hat? You can wear mine. And then we swapped hats. I put that thing on, so that's in the end of the film.
Yeah,
it shows real scenes from the island raid, right? And it has one where I don't know who took the picture, but I think it's Mark Mabry. I popped my head up to look around, and he snapped the picture. I'm on the beach. I think I'm in handcuffs.
Yeah,
you know, but there's the hat. So
hey,
that's real.
1-0.
Yeah.
What do you think about that island scene? How did that play?
That was a very difficult scene to shoot because we had like, you know, 54 children shooting. And, you know, you can only shoot 5 hours a day. We're shooting in the sand. It was very, very complex. You know, Gorka, we call it Gorka, you know.
He was wearing like tidy whitey.
Yeah.
I remember that. Like, what's this guy?
You jump in the water. But, you know, the challenge is the light. And, you know, there's, you know, the best way to shoot at that is like the magic hour. Magic hour only lasts for a certain amount of time and with all the kids and everything. So, it was very complicated. I actually, it was the hardest scene, that and shooting the escape at night in the jungle. Those two scenes, you know, took everything out of us. It was those scenes that we full finished and I was like, oh man, did we get it? Did we get it?
Dude, you were so stressed.
Oh.
I think I said two words to you.
Yeah.
You
did not want to
talk. Yeah, you were there too with me. Yeah. It was a skeleton.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was a funny story. So I don't like belts. I'm not a belt, never. So I always, when I buy my clothes, I make sure this fits perfect because I don't wear belts. And we were on just location scouting and my pants were falling. And I was like, man, I need a belt. So I own one belt and it's the belt that I bought in Colombia.
Because you
know, I don't use belts.
You stopped eating.
Yeah, but I still use a belt. I have one belt. And I remembered, I was like, I got to buy a belt because either I do that or buy a bunch of jeans. So, yes, I lost a lot of weight. And it was not because we were not eating. It was because we were not sleeping.
Yeah. Oh, that too.
Yeah.
Okay, artifact number two.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. I'll give you that one.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen this?
Yeah.
No.
You've seen the actual?
I saw the actual because they bought the, I don't know how they got it, but the art department.
Had it.
Maybe you gave it to them.
I promise you, when you open it, there won't be a picture of a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been sanitized.
Oh, good.
But open that up.
Remember? Kanamori.
Kanamori. And there he is, man. There's the there's the real deal right there. Never
crazy, you know.
And he and that actor you got, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it was really hard. Nobody wanted to play that role.
I'm sure.
He didn't want to play that role. You know that? Did you know that story?
Wait, wait, before you do that, look at the inscription. There it is. Like, you added a little bit to it in the movie, I think. The bravest man I know. To Agent Ballard, but he just wrote, to Agent Ballard, live well, con amore. In the film, you call them something different. You call them Genghis. Know what you call them?
Yeah.
Genghis Khan.
Because we didn't want to pay rights.
Yeah. You know.
But, you
so
know.
So tell me about the
yeah, so he came, he didn't audition. I just love his picture and his face. And I said to the casting director, I was like, I really want him. And it's like, well, he won't audition because he doesn't really want to play that role. And then I was like, well, I want to see if he can act. So they sent me his reel. And I was like, okay, his look is amazing. I know he can pull it off. So he didn't want to even audition for it. So we got a meeting and I had to convince him.
How'd you convince him?
Just told him the big picture. Is like, hey, brother, you know, you're obviously, you know, I know how hard it is to play that role because it's very interesting how people don't mind playing. Like, you know, the antagonist in movies, you know, as if they can play murderers and this, but pedophiles,
yeah.
They don't want to play them. And you know who also didn't want to play this role? And I had to meet him and like literally skip the same Bachman. He refused. He wanted to play Batman. So he did came to audition for Batman. And I said, wow, this guy's an amazing actor. You know, he's in a lot of movies, you know, Buchanan.
And he speaks Spanish.
Yeah, I know he's a great actor. And he you know, we went for coffee and I was like, man, please, you know, and he's like, let me think about it. And he says, I gotta talk to my wife about it. And then a phone call and he again said, hey, you know, any chance about Batman? I was like, look, Batman it's gone. It's like, we're ready. It's close. And then finally, he's like, fine. And if you think about it, you know, and he was such a great actor. You know that thing when he goes and he goes like,
yeah,
you know, I went, I was like, can you do it again? And he says, no, he didn't want to do it again. Oh, you know, when he does like,
he was almost traumatized.
Yeah. He's like, I don't want to do it again. Like, all right. And then we mark it and we're using it in the movie, you know, that whole, you know, but it's really interesting, you know, even what happens to pedophiles in jails. It's like there's justice and at that level and people don't want to play.
Well, I can relate very well because I once had to act as a pedophile.
Yeah.
That's the real thing that was in the movie.
Yeah.
Right? Where it was it's much easier to act the role of my undercover persona.
Yeah.
A different name, a different story.
Yeah.
That was me playing myself.
Yeah.
I had to play myself as a pedophile. People are surprised to hear that some of these things are real.
Yeah.
You know, like, did you really have to play yourself as a pedophile? I said, yeah, I was Special Agent Tim Ballard and a closet pedophile. Yeah. And that's how I got to the guy who I arrested.
Yeah.
And I cracked him. Do you remember this? I sent you a 45-minute or maybe an hour-long interview between me and Kanagari.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Remember this?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you called me and said, that was the creepiest thing I've ever listened to.
That's why in that scene when he's washing his face, he wants to kind of take that persona off, you know, when you know, Timoteo goes into the bathroom.
Do you remember what I told you I did in real life?
You vomited, right?
You vomited.
I vomited, and then I grabbed a wipey, like one of those like Clorox bleach wipes, and just like as if it's something was stuck on my face.
Yeah,
and I had to go for about a month and a half.
Yeah,
and I'd go back and hang with him, and then we ended up at a coffee shop. True story, you know. And I wish I had said that line though. I wish I had said that line that Jim said.
That was James. That came out of nowhere.
I came out of nowhere. And it almost seemed out of context until you gave it two beats and you're like, oh my gosh. Because the way the actor responded, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And Jim's just like, oh my, dude, I love that.
Did you see that yesterday? You see? There's a minor, I haven't seen the movie, by the way, this new cut. I don't know, have you?
Yeah.
I just know scene, they did a little, that was just pure creative. I think Brian played with it a little bit. And I think he according to Brian, is way better.
Oh, wow. I can't watch the movies, you know. I'll come at the end and speak, but I can't.
Yeah.
I can't put myself through that very easily.
Yeah, I don't think I've watched this movie since when Gorka came to do color correction for Cabrini, which was like a year, almost 2 years ago. We watched it just to, but that was another cut. This cut I haven't seen.
I'm gonna watch it next week for sure.
So one of my
in the theaters. I'm definitely watching it in the theaters.
My two favorite scenes in the film. It's so hard to do this, but I want to ask both of you what yours is. But my two favorite scenes aren't what you think. They're not the action scenes, not even the island scene, as much as, I fell apart. I only came to the set twice.
Mm-hmm.
I had to see if Jim was going to kiss Mira.
Yeah.
Remember that? That was an awkward.
Yeah.
We can tell that story.
Yeah.
Let me tell that story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy story. And then I had to go on the island because that was, I don't know why, that was very particular to me.
Yeah.
And you nailed it, especially the island scene. It was just like, at the end, I was sobbing at the end. Remember? It's
yeah.
Like, oh my gosh! Like it was like a full like recall. Yeah. But that's not my favorite scenes. My favorite scene is the coffee shop scene, and largely because Jim pulls that line about the millstone line. I don't want to, no spoiler alerts, okay? But the millstone line was like so powerful. And then seeing the kid, you know, the book, and you know he did. He put pictures of the kids in the books. You know, he had copies of them. That's how he delivered messages or just gross stuff. But the other scene is with Batman, with Zampiro, when he said, "You're a cartel guy, what are you doing?"
Yeah,
and he comes back. Man, I mean, Bill Camp could win an Academy Award for that scene.
Yeah.
And Jim doesn't say much, but something, you notice his eyes. Because I remember you told me before you agreed on Jim, you said, whoever we pick has to act more through their eyes than through their mouth. Remember, you told me that?
Yeah, yeah.
And do you think Jim did it?
Jim did it. And, you know, all kudos and credit to you because you saw it. And I remember I was so stuck with the hair, you know, your one of your signatures is your hair. So I was like, you know, the only reason I couldn't see Jim is because he has black hair or dark hair. And he was so open because the story is so close to him because he adopted three kids. I mean, he already rescued three kids. I think we went 2 or 3 days later to his house and we dyed his hair blonde. And I remember I sent you the picture and we put it back. I was like, wow. I mean,
what?
Do you remember? Well, I don't want to give it a spoiler.
You don't want to give it away, but I know what you're going to say.
But when the transition, people were not realizing.
I know. It's crazy.
So we had to go black and white because if we would have stayed color, people were not realizing.
So what he's talking about, this is interesting, is the concern in the beginning of Jim was we don't look like each other. By the end of the movie, something happens. It's a cool thing that they do. It actually surprised me too. And they had made him look so much like me that they had to I'll just say this much. There's some real footage at the end because we filmed the operation. And they had to make me black and white and him color to do something because you had made him look so much like me. It was crazy. So strange. What are your favorite scenes?
Well, I think you mentioned one of mine right there, you know, where Bill Camp sort of Vampiro does his, and this is how I got into it. What, you know, Tim, you in the movie is like, you could have quit. You know, why are you doing this? And he sits down and that is, I think, an amazing piece of acting right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember the conversation we had about that bit of dialogues. And you called, it's like, I don't remember where you were. Maybe you were even down there. I don't think so. But you're like, we need a scene right here that does this. And I do remember sitting there and like, okay, this could be a very flat scene if we write it this way. Or what would be a crazy way to approach it? What would be just a new, you know? And
yeah.
I had to sort of, it was just one of those weird things. And then I sent it to Alejandro. It was like, this, Alejandro added lines, this, come back. But it was just one of those, it took about an hour, but it's a memorable scene, the writing of it, which I can't remember many other scenes writing, but that one I remember really clearly because there was some stuff that came out that I don't know exactly, you know, I don't know exactly where it's just, sometimes it's just poetry, you know?
Right.
Okay, here you go, you know?
But one of the taglines, the key lines, I mean, my three favorite lines in the whole movie. Of course, God's children are not for sale. That's the first meeting with Vampiro. The scripture, the millstone scripture, and then that scene, how that scene ends. When God tells you what to do.
You can't hesitate.
You cannot hesitate. How about you, favorite scene?
Mine is very simple. Is when Miguel gives you the medal and says, go find my sister, and grabs the medal, and then he stands up and looks and is the silhouette with the medal outside. It's just very kind of like graphic novel, and it kind of has this language of the heroic journey, you know, the hero's journey. So it's like, it's almost like, okay, the journey begins here. So it's like very, very symbolic.
And a powerful scene that we call like the payoff scene is, I don't want to give too much away again, but when he places that, I mean, I just loved when he places that, the necklace into the hand of Rocio, and you're thinking, what is she thinking right now? This mysterious dude, what is she thinking? She's sitting there and just like, you gotta be kidding me, right? I mean, I get chills. Sorry, audience, you don't know what I'm saying because you're gonna have to watch the movie, but these guys don't know what I'm talking about. Now, do you remember saying about that necklace? I suggested to leave that out of the movie. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Do you remember why?
Yeah, because people would not believe it. It's like, this is, you know, always one thing. Because, you know, we started writing another project. I think it was called The Mogul. And it was fiction. This is before we met you. And we were already called to do something about this horror. And we started writing a complete fictionary story. And we created all these characters and this and that and that. And then get a phone call from Eduardo and says, have you guys started writing the script? I was like, no, we just finished the outline. He's like, well, stop. You got to meet Tim Ballard. And when we just heard a little bit about your story, automatically, normally fiction surpasses reality. And here was the opposite. And the metal was one of those elements where like, you're like, you can't believe it. But as the storytellers, we knew it was going to be in the movie. It's like, this is going to be in the movie.
I was worried because I just thought it's such a sacred thing that this kid brings me this necklace. My name's on the necklace.
Yeah.
Right. Because there's a scripture, you know, and you modified the necklace a bit, which I think is cool. And I was afraid to put it out because if people thought something was false, that was sacred and true, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way because no one's going to believe that kid gave me a necklace. Well,
one thing to add to that, Albert Einstein, this is one of my favorite quotes from Albert Einstein. It says, God hides in the coincidences. So that coincidence that the medal had your name, that I always think when I read that quote, it's like, it looked like a coincidence, but it was really a calling.
Yeah.
So.
Now in the film, you made a modification where it's so sweet. You see when Rocio walks into her room. At the end, and she's wearing the necklace, you know, and she has it back. Do you remember the story of the necklace?
Yes. You have it. That's the third.
We
will know what it is.
I don't know if you've ever actually. This is the actual.
Never seen it.
This is the actual necklace. I keep it in a vault or keep it in a display case. I pulled it out for this show. I don't think
it's in the sequel too.
Oh, that's right.
The vault.
That's right.
You will see
the necklace in the vault. Yeah, that's where I keep that.
Retakes
the kit. Yeah,
yeah.
But that's the actual one. The little boy. His name's not Miguel, right?
Oh, that's also another one of my favorite scenes. Timoteo, when they're eating the burgers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very endearing scene because, you know, what's your name, Tim? But you can call me Timoteo. Timoteo. You know that whole exchange. It's very powerful. You know, I still call Jim Timoteo.
Yeah, I've
still call him Timoteo. Hey, Timoteo.
Look at this nickel and dime store fake dog tag necklace. Isn't that crazy? And now it's one of the most valuable possessions that I own. Someday I want to go find those kids. I mean, I can find them. I know where they are. But I can't, we've hidden their identity, obviously, in a very creative way. But I'd love to go give it to them someday. I feel like it's theirs, you know? But, you know, they qualified for T visas, people ask. If you're abused by an American, you get a T visa, which means you're fast track into the United States as a citizen. So I know where they are, but I'm not allowed to contact them because of through the therapy. They thought it was better to, so traumatic, some things even.
And they don't know anything about.
No. We've made sure. Yeah. I mean, you guys were creative enough to make sure that that's not.
Yeah. And it's different enough from what they
did. It's different.
Which was important.
So, as we close this out, I want to talk. Maybe it's way premature, but but maybe not because we're getting requests already. I don't know what happened a couple of years ago because Sound of Freedom 1 was stalled. I was always at peace. I knew God had a plan. So it went from, it was Fox and then Disney, and then it went through the hands of several people with had the rights. And it was kind of, sometimes when we get together, we'd be stressed.
Yeah.
Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
How can this, yeah, like how can it be good? But somehow I just, remember how many times I told you, like, bro,
yeah.
Be at peace because there's a reason.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, like you said, boom.
Yeah.
Just the right partners. Yeah. Here we go. Yeah. And it was the first time I felt it. I didn't feel anything with Fox. I felt nothing with Disney. I felt nothing, very little with others. But when I met these guys, and you know the story how I met them? I had been asked, this is a crazy story. I was invited to the set of The Chosen. And I didn't know by who. But my family was so excited because that's our favorite movie or TV show. So we go to it's called Goshen, Utah. And it's like to scale Jerusalem. Or pieces of whatever, but it's just amazing. So we're sitting there in the middle of Jerusalem, down by I think the pool of the Bethesda. It's that in that area. And I look over and I see two of the Harmon brothers, who I recognized from years back. I'd met them and I said, "Guys, what's up?" You know, we started talking, and they said, "What are you working on?" I said, "Well, there's this film. It's about to, you know, the rights are about to expire." And then after they did, and I called them. That's when I called you, and
yeah.
Everyone was like, "What? Like, we don't want to be. Yeah. This is not a faith film. It's not like a overtly, you know,
it's faith friendly, but it's not. Yeah. It's yeah."
And we were worried. And for me, it was like, I don't know. I don't care. I don't necessarily go with the rational stuff. My whole soul was like, just full of happiness and like the fruits of the spirit. I'm like, it's them. And we finally got everyone together in 5 days. 5 days made a deal, fastest deal maybe ever.
Yeah,
and because they had to get the, you know, to be the trailer. Then I found out the person who invited me, they said, "Hey, the person who invited you," because we didn't know why we were there, because the other people on set had given like hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you know, I think I give a measly $200 a month to The Chosen, you know, because we want to feel part of it. It was Jonathan Romey. I had no idea he even knew who we were. The guy who plays Jesus.
Okay.
So he walks over and says, "I'm the one who invited you." And it was like, we took pictures with him. My kids were like going crazy. But the real purpose for being there was the Sound of Freedom.
Yeah.
That was the purpose.
Yeah.
That's how the deal was made.
Yeah.
On the set of The Chosen.
And looking, you know, I was one of the main ones that was very frustrated because we put so much into that film, put our lives, and we age dramatically. And here we are finishing another film, and I'm like, what's happening to Sound of Freedom? So I was getting very frustrated and thinking that nobody was doing anything, right? I'm like, it's just there. But now looking into retrospective, we could not have been in better hands than we are today. We could not. I mean, think about if this movie would be with Fox. You think they will give the attention or the nurturing that this movie needs? Like what the Harmon brothers are doing? It's like, so we needed to wait because we needed Angel Studios to kind of like, we weren't in parallel, you know?
We were.
So it's
do you know,
totally makes sense. But you can only see that when you look back, you know?
Well, let me tell you something. The point of decision for me when I left the job and engaged in Columbia was December of 2013. That's when it started.
Yeah.
The operation went down on October 11th, 2014. Angel Studios recently told me. Angel Studios was born in December of 2013, the same time we were born. The mission was born, same month. And so we both kind of, we took our lickings. I mean, they were sued by Disney and we were beat up all over the place. And we finally kind of, you know, the two rivers met at the head and there was magic.
Yeah. Amen, brother.
So.
Well, hopefully we're going for the next one.
I'm excited. I don't want to put the horse in front of the cart, but Sound of Freedom 2.
Isn't the horse always go in front of the cart?
Oh, come on. Well, how'd I mess up? You messed up twice. I get one.
Yeah,
you have none yet. So I don't want to put the cart in front of the
horse. I was trying to really like figure out the logistics.
So anyway, cart in front of the horse. And Sound of Freedom 2 is phenomenal. Phenomenal script. All the good parts of
it has the best twist that came Came from an inspiration from you.
It did, yeah. It's got some twist. The intense parts of Sound of Freedom, the thriller parts, are double in Sound of Freedom 2.
Or triple.
The emotional, personal, double what you see in Sound of Freedom 1. It's very personal to me.
Yeah.
Because it gets into my personal life.
Yeah.
And talks about two of my children in a very powerful way. And anyway, so excited. It looks like a lot of... They could be filming that. You guys could be filming that by the end of the year. I mean...
Well, if it all depends. I mean, I think things are looking really good with Sound of Freedom. So when everything comes together, I mean, we're going to find out in 10 days.
That's the crazy thing. Like,
in 10 days, we'll know.
Data will be coming in soon. It's not... It's always been in the future.
Yeah.
It's no longer the future.
How does that feel as filmmakers... I feel it a little bit, but not like you do all this work and here you come, the day begins and you, here it goes. That's gotta be like.
It's the same thing as drilling to find oil. I one day I had the smart idea to go into that and obviously it didn't work out well, but they start on a Monday and by Friday, you know, if you lost every dime or you are really rich. In my case, we lost every dime, but it was Monday and on Friday, you know. Here's the same thing. Is we come out and by Monday, numbers come in and it's two, there's gold, there's oil, or it's dry. But it seems right now that there's pre-sales is incredible already.
Yeah, I was talking to one of the Harmon brothers and they were talking about, this sounds like I'm exaggerating, but I'm not, according to these, and they're very conservative in how they count their numbers, but... It could be record-breaking right now in terms of the amount of people who have bought tickets, and they don't want me to say the number, you know what it is.
Yeah.
But it's insane.
Yeah.
Tickets already purchased, theaters already selling out. So it's almost already a success.
Yeah.
Already, it's pretty phenomenal. If you ever got your tickets, it's the week of July 4th, and it's angel.com/freedom. Go see Sound of Freedom, 2 million children. Stuck in slavery today, psych slavery. And we want 2 million people in theaters week one, representing each and every one of those kids. I have a feeling it's going to be more than 2 million. But if we get 2 million, we will be thrilled. So thanks, guys, for tuning in. Thanks, Rod. Thanks, Alejandro, for joining me. And we'll bring you back to talk about Sound of Freedom 2 when we're ready to roll on that. All right, guys. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time on the Tim Ballard Podcast.